afternoon and welcome everyone to today's Internet Web Seminar entitled Mind Tailings, Enumeration, and Remediation. This web seminar is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. This is the second in our 2011-2012 series designed to share Superfund research that aligns with the scientific needs in the Environmental Protection Agency. Our presenters have already given a live seminar to project managers at EPA Region 9 headquarters and are reprising their presentations today to reach an even larger audience interested in mining issues. I'm Sarah Wilkinson, Research Translation Corps Coordinator at the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program, and I will be the moderator for today's session. We'll get started in just a few moments, but I'll cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to the seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We've also included short bio sketches of the presenters, and their email addresses are available as well. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, your phones were placed on mute when you joined the call. We will have a question and answer session, at which point you can take your phone off mute. We ask that phone participants keep your phones on mute during the question and answer session unless you are asking a question. To unmute your phone during the question and answer session, you will need to dial *7. You may also need to press your phone's mute button if you previously put yourself on mute. You need to place your phone back on mute after your question by pressing *6 or using the mute button. So once again, that's *6 to mute and *7 to unmute. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the transmission. And please do not put us on hold, as many organizations may have music or advertisements that can be disruptive. By now, those of you participating via the phone line should have the presentation open and should be on *1. All of those participating via the Internet should have clicked on Go To Session icon near the bottom of the page and also be on *1 of the presentation. As explained on *2, the main page contains the slides above which you will find navigation icons. Internet participants may submit questions by using the question icon you see above the slide and need not wait until the question and answer period to submit. In fact, we encourage you to submit your questions in advance of the Q&A session. If you experience any technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the difficulties, and please include your telephone number where you can be reached and we'll try to help you troubleshoot the problem. The presenter will be announcing of the slide to which he or she is moving. You may advance to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. At the end of the presentation, we'll walk you through our links page where we have assembled resources. And associated with that is an online feedback form. We would ask that you consider filling that out as we do look at your comments to improve our seminars. These resources will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can also access it later. And the seminars will be placed in an archive with a soundtrack, which you will be able to access in the near future as they were given today. Past web seminars are available on the CLUIN website and also accessible via iTunes by searching for Superfund Research Programs, which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information or CLUIN archive. And with that, we are ready to start the session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute, and again, please do not put us on hold. Our first presenter today is Dr. Eric Betterton. Eric Betterton is the head of the Department of Atmospheric Sciences and the Institute of Atmospheric Physics at the University of Arizona, with appointments in the Department of Chemical and Environmental Engineering and in the College of Public Health. Dr. Betterton was born and raised in Zimbabwe. He received his undergraduate degree from the University of Natal, South Africa, received his Ph.D. in chemical kinetics from the University of Witwatersrand, South Africa, and trained as a postdoctoral research associate in acid rain and fog at the California Institute of Technology. His research interests focus on air pollution, particularly atmospheric aerosols and dust associated with mining operations, as well as solar energy, rain, snow and ice chemistry, remediation of polluted groundwater, and environmental fate of sodium azide found in automobile airbags. Today, Dr. Betterton will be discussing his work on atmospheric aerosols from mining operations in Hayden and Dewey Humboldt, Arizona. Take it away, Dr. Betterton.
Thank you, Sarah, and hello, everybody. It's difficult to know what time zone you're in, so if I slip back into saying good morning, you know what it's all about. It's 11 o'clock or shortly after 11 o'clock in Arizona here. What I'd like to do for the next 30 or 40 minutes is to describe work that we're conducting at two Superfund sites in Arizona, and they, you can see a photograph of them on slide number three. The one site is at Hayden. That's the Asarco site. That's both an active mine and an active smelter. And you can see the slag pour there on the left. It's pretty impressive when you're there. There's molten lava pours down the side of that pit there, and lots of smoke and steam comes off the top. In the middle is the smelter stack. That's about 1,000 foot high. I believe it's the tallest freestanding structure in the state of Arizona. But it's not a source of pollutants like lead and arsenic, so a lot of attention is given to that stack, but probably unfairly. And then the second site is a full-fledged Superfund site. It's up near Prescott, very near to the twin towns of Dewey Humboldt, and we call that Iron King or Dewey Humboldt. You can see a bit of dust blowing off that site when that particular photograph was taken. So moving on to slide number four then, this is a pretty good time to be talking about dust here in Arizona. National Public Radio did a series late last year on what they called poisoned places, focusing on air. And of the 10 or 20,000 sites they could have selected, they selected, I think it was four, and one of the four was Hayden, just up the road here. And you can see that EPA is focused on Hayden, and mainly because of lead and arsenic and other toxic materials that are found in the dust and in the air as well. And there's a snapshot of the 1,000-foot stack, and the smelter operations, which tend to hug the ground, they're about two or three stories high, but they're not well enclosed, and so there's a lot of fume that escapes there. And we think it's that fume that dominates the lead and the arsenic in the area. Moving on to slide five, other reasons we're interested in dust and aerosols are because of the effects of dust storms on public health and public safety. Again, late last year, we had yet another pileup on Interstate 10. That's the big freeway between Phoenix and Tucson. When the wind begins to blow, abandoned farms in the area become a strong source of dust, and collisions occur, and people die every year. People die on that freeway due to dust storms. At the bottom of that slide, you can see a view from Tucson, basically, Kitt Peak and Astronomical area, looking north, and that haze in the background there is that dust storm that impacted the I-10 near Phoenix. So as you'll see in the talk, I'll be focusing a lot on the diameter of a particular particle rather than talking about PM10. Those are particles with a diameter of 10 microns and less. I'll be chopping it up into many smaller size bins. And the reason we do that is because the diameter of the particle affects its properties in some very fundamental ways. Big particles drop out of the air very quickly, so they're not transported very far, whereas the fine particles do get transported very far. We here in Arizona have seen dust coming from the Gobi Desert in China, for example. So those fine particles made it right across the Pacific and down the west coast and even made it to Tucson. And then whereabouts these particles get deposited in the human respiratory system is also strongly dependent on the particle diameter. So particle diameter and the variability of that is a big theme here. Moving to slide number six, that figure on the right from Seinfeld and Pandas is a very famous one. They simply adopted another one that's out there in the literature. But it clearly shows that most atmospheric aerosols are found in three size modes. On the right-hand side is the coarse mode, centered at about 10 microns diameter. And then to the left of that vertical dotted line are the fine particles, and those are subdivided into fine and ultrafine or ultrafine accumulation mode. So looking at the coarse particles there, centered at about 10 microns diameter, What's important about them is they originate from mechanical action only. By mechanical action, we mean windblown dust or off-road vehicles, something like that. So if you capture coarse particles, and you can see that they're coarse particles because you selected the inlet, well, you know that there was some sort of mechanical action associated with their source. The finer particles are not created by mechanical action, and the reason is because they are so small, they have a relatively high surface area, and so the van der Waals interaction between particles is very strong, and so you just can't dislodge them by the wind, for example. Wind action is not very efficient at dislodging small particles. Instead, they come from the condensation of hot vapors, like from smelting operations, for example, or condensation of oily droplets out of tailpipes of vehicles. The ultrafine particles down at about 0.01 micron diameter are very small. They move around rapidly in the atmosphere. By Brownian diffusion, they collide with each other, they coagulate, and so they're lost from the atmosphere by coagulation. They're too small to settle. And they grow into that area about 0.2 microns or so, 0.5 microns, called the accumulation mode. And it's called the accumulation mode because the particles accumulate there. They are too big to move rapidly by Brownian diffusion, yet they're too small to settle by gravity, and so they just hang around, and they eventually get washed out and rained out. That's the only way that they're lost. And that's why it's called the accumulation mode. Particles in that mode stick around and accumulate until they get rained out or washed out. So that's the typical size distribution, trimodal size distribution that you find in the atmosphere. And if you know the size of the particles containing, say, lead or arsenic, if you know that they're fine or ultrafine, you immediately know something about their source. They're not due to windblown action, for example. So moving on to slide number 7, we have two Superfund sites, one up near Prescott, North Phoenix. We call that Iron King or Humboldt Dewey, Dewey Humboldt. There is an inactive smelter there, and there's a mine tailings associated with there. And it's a Superfund site because it's loaded with arsenic lead in the tailings and very high concentrations, roughly 0.5% of each. Hayden Winkleman, or ASALCO, is not officially a Superfund site, but close to it, and the EPA obviously has some interest there, has a presence there. So those are the two Superfund sites we are sitting at. The other sites, the comparison sites there, are there for background measurements like Mount Lemmon, 9,000 feet, just north of Tucson. Tucson itself for an urban environment. Green Valley, there's active mining down there, and so we can get clean tailings from them. And then the Wilcox Plier is a great big natural dust source, a dry basin. Moving on to slide 8, I just want to focus here on some of the sampling techniques we're using at those Superfund sites. The top one is the Moody Micro Orifice Uniform Deposit Impactor. And what it is a series of impaction stages that accelerate the airflow sequentially through 10 size fractions. And they thereby accelerate particles onto different stages, and we're able to collect the big particles at the top. They are easy to accelerate and make to impact on a stage. And then right at the bottom, we've accelerated the smallest particles the most, and we get them to impact the stage, and we collect them. And then we have these, the aerosol now divided into 10 different size fractions, and we're able to examine them under a microscope, and we're able to chemically analyze those fractions separately, which gives us a lot of insight into the sources of those particles. Other techniques we have don't make too much use of the scanning mobility particle sizer anymore. But that the number concentration, not mass concentration, but number concentration for very, very small particles down near the gas phase. TSP, we run there at Hayden and at Ion King to get the total suspended particulate. And then we have a weather station there to determine wind speed, wind direction, to help us determine where the source is. And then we have a couple of optical particle monitors. We call them dust tracks, and I'll get to those later. Moving on to slide number 9. This just shows you that the Moody actually does a very good job. If we collect all the stages from 9.9 microns and downwards, we have the equivalent of PM10, and you can see whether it be arsenic, cadmium, or lead collected by those stages of the Moody, they're very close to actual PM10 measurements made by the EPA on that very same site. Similarly, if you sum all those 10 stages on the Moody, 18 microns and down, you can compare those summed concentrations or masses to the actual TSP sample, and again, the comparison is very good. So we have a lot of confidence in that Moody is doing what it should do. Moving on to slide number 10, now we're focusing on Hayden, and here we have an annual average. So we've been out there for a number of years, and this is just a snapshot of 2009. And it shows the lead, cadmium, and arsenic concentration in each of those size fractions, going from gas phase, which is like the after filter, all the way up to 18 microns. And the thing to note here is that you get a bimodal distribution. Much of the toxic material, lead, cadmium, arsenic, is concentrated in that accumulation mode, say about 0.3, 0.5 microns. And then there's a second mode, the coarse mode, run about 10 microns. And simply looking at that size distribution immediately tells you that you have two sources of lead, cadmium, arsenic. On the coarse side, you have mechanical action. It could be wind-blown dust. It could be vehicle activity on dusty roads. And an accumulation mode, run about 0.5 microns. You have something else. You have that condensation of fume. You have Brownian motion. You have coagulation of particles, which is pretty nice. The one thing about the Moody you should be aware of, in order to get a measurable sample, we have to run it for 96 hours. So time resolution is not great, but you do get this additional information, which is very, very useful. So moving on to slide number 11. Given those kind of data, you have them every 96 hours, you can slice and dice. And here we have, looking at the bottom portion, that PM less than 1, so this is a submicron fraction. We have the submicron lead, arsenic, and cadmium plotted by month of the year, and so you can see seasonal changes in the concentrations of submicron fraction. You can see no matter what month of the year, it's the submicron that contains most of the toxic material. And you can also see other interesting features. Around about May, June, the plant shut down, the smelter shut down, and so that submicron fraction disappeared. We were mystified by that at the first time we saw it. We thought there was some sort of atmospheric mixing going on, whatever it was. No, it was after the fact that we discovered the plant was shut down. So sometimes the simplest answer is the best. Going on to slide number 12, it's possible to run the Moody and switch it on only when the wind is coming out of a certain direction or when it's running at a certain speed or both a certain speed and a certain direction. And this is just one example of that kind of data collection. In this case, we turned the Moody on only when the wind was coming out of the northwest. You can see that on that wind rose. Most of those, the wind is coming from the northwesterly direction, and the speed varies from greater than 5 meters per second down to calm conditions, but mainly out of the northwest. And the Moody is located on the Hayden High School, which happens to be southeast of the smelter. So when we're looking northwest, we're looking at the smelter. And I have smelter in inverted commas there because the topography is really, really complicated. and just a bird's eye view of where the smelter is does not tell you where the particles are coming from, but this gives you a sense of the fact that you can switch this thing on and off depending on the meteorology. Again, most of the lead and the arsenic and the cadmium is in about the accumulation mode, about 0.3 to 0.5 microns, as expected if it were fume coming from the smelter. Changing direction on slide number 13, this site is characterized by very clean air coming from the northeast, so we call that our background, again, complicated topography. And so we turned the Moody on when the air was coming from the northeast quadrant. You can see the windrows there. And in this case, the concentrations overall are much lower. The scale is the same between slide 12 and slide 13. But again, you see some of those accumulation mode particles. And I suspect that is due to the air sloshing upwards and downwards. So during the latter part of the day when it's warm, the air is flowing upstream, and there is the Gila River there. And then in the evening, it flows back downstream, and we're seeing some of that residual accumulation of particle that started with the smelter. We can also examine those individual stages by scanning electron microscopy. And the great thing about using a Moody to do this is that you can select the smaller particles, and they're not lost in all the big particles. If you simply examine the TSP filter under a scanning electron microscope, you would be horribly lost. You would not see the small particles because they're buried under the big particles. I'm on slide 14 now. Thank you, Sarah. So looking at the fine fraction here, this is about the 0.5 micron particles. On the right, you can see this is a lead particle. It's very spherical, which immediately tells you that it condensed, it froze, so it must have had some sort of high temperature operations associated with its immediate past. You can also see a smaller lead particle that diffused and coagulated with the bigger one, so you know, theory is verified there. It's really interesting. And then the left image shows both the spherical particle, which must have come from high temperature operations, and the more granular particles, which must have come from wind-blown dust. So there we have evidence of the dust, and we have evidence of those particles, and I suspect that those particles, the lead particles, are actually depositing onto the soil, and then they're being suspended later by the wind, and that would explain why we're getting lead and arsenic, even in the coarse fraction. So moving on to slide 15, more imagery of both lead and arsenic-containing particles. Because you can analyze those individual particles whilst they're on the scanning electron microscope, you can do a chemical elemental analysis. The top particle is dominated by lead, as you can see. The bottom particle dominated by arsenic, and other elements show up as well, depending on what you're looking for. But it's pretty cool when you can separate the particles. You can see them very clearly, and you can do chemical analysis on those individual particles, and it tells you a lot about what they are and where they come from. Moving on to slide number 16, other work that you can do when you've separated the particles into different sizes is you can calculate a so-called enrichment factor. We use scandium as a reference element. Scandium has no atherogenic sources that we're aware of. So it's like a marker for soil, for natural aerosols. And then you can reference your particular element of interest, like arsenic, to scandium, and then calculate the ratios and calculate an enrichment factor. And if you look at the submicron fraction on the far left of that graph, you'll see that arsenic, lead, and cadmium are all enriched with respect to scandium, and which is what you'd expect near the vicinity of the smelter. And lead and arsenic are very strongly enriched, going from a factor of 10 to a factor of more than 100, depending on the particular element. Moving on to lead isotopes, slide number 17. This figure comes from the literature, and it shows that if you analyze the lead for the different stable isotopes there, lead 206, 207, and 208, you can actually characterize the nature of the ore from which the lead originates. The lead isotopes are characteristic of the particular ore body. And this particular slide comes from work in Russia, where they have a lot of different lead mines and different ores. So you can see a decent spread of the lead isotope ratios depending on the ore. And we've just begun this work at Hayden, so it's by no means definitive. We wanted to see, first of all, if by ICP mass spec we could actually do lead isotopes, and we can, which for us is a big step forward. You don't need very sophisticated, expensive techniques to do lead isotopes. So we accumulated a couple of the impaction stages near the accumulation mode and a few from the coarse mode, around about 6.3 microns diameter, and then do the lead isotope work on those fractions. And slide 19 shows you what we discovered. This was the first shot. So the coarse fraction, those are particles larger than about 3.2 microns diameter, have stable lead isotope ratios which are down near the bottom left of this particular plot. So low isotopic ratios characterizing the coarse fraction, whereas the fine fraction gathered on that Moody are characterized by higher ratios towards the top right of that particular space. And as I said, we don't have much of a climatology to talk about yet, but we can distinguish between lead in the coarse and the fine fractions, apparently. Moving on to the slide number 20, we also sampled the air in Tucson on the campus of the University of Arizona. And you can see those stable lead isotopes are characterized towards the bottom left-hand side of that curve. And what's missing is the coarse fraction up at the top there. Well, I should say the higher isotopic ratios at the top. So there is a difference between Tucson and Hayden, as expected, and that difference presumably is associated with the different lead sources. So Hayden is smelting a copper ore, and lead is a byproduct of that. Tucson lead, not sure where that comes from. Could be residual from lead in gasoline in years past and then resuspended. I'm not sure, but there it is. We moved to Iron King to sample not the aerosol phase with the Moody, but to get a snapshot of what the soil looks like and what the TSP looks like. And there you have it for Iron King on slide 21. The amazing thing about Iron King, this is a real eye-opener for us, is the numerical value of those isotopic ratios. On the y-axis for Iron King, you see the numbers starting at about 2.2, which is much higher than the ending point for Tucson or Hayden. And then similarly with the x-axis, those ratios are very, very high. We haven't seen those before, indicating a different lead source for the Iron King tailings, which I guess should be expected. Also at Iron King, and we're moving away from Hayden over the next few months towards Iron King on slide 22, we've deployed these optical particle monitors. The trade name is DustTrack. And what's really nice about them is in real time, within resolution of an order of seconds, it not only counts the number of particles coming through, but also estimates the diameter of those particles and therefore gets a mass concentration. It has an estimate of the mass concentration. It's not as good as the TOM or a regular PM10, but it's pretty good, and the real-time measurements are just fantastic for doing a dust flux. If the wind blows, you want to know how much dust is blowing at that particular time for the next few minutes. You don't want the 24-hour average. These dust track monitors are very small as well. They're about, I don't know, 9 inches on a side. They're battery driven. They have their own data logger on board. And so you can set them out with a size selective inlet, like a PM10 inlet, and just let them run and then come back in a week or two and download the data, which is what we started doing at Iron King. So moving on to slide 23, right in the middle there, you can see we put a dust track monitor inside a plastic box, and that little blue inlet there with a hat on it, that's the PM10 size selective inlet. The dust track is inside the box with an extra battery to protect it from the weather. And in the background is the phytoremediation work that Rena is doing at Iron King. So we work in close collaboration. The plot on the left shows where the vegetation is being planted, and our intention is to put up two 10-meter towers upwind and downwind, in inverted commas, of that vegetated site. So over the next few years, we can determine the effects of vegetation on dust as a function of particle size and as a function of chemical composition of that particular dust. So we're out there now. We're just spinning up. We don't have much data to show you. Moving on to slide 24. Again, you can see the dust that is kicked up when it gets windy in that area. And I remind you that dust contains about 0.5% arsenic and 0.5% lead. So it is not a good place to be walking around without a dust mask. On the right, that picture there shows one of the towers going up. We have in view, we have two dust tracks, those greenish boxes, and there's another one near the top. And we have a small weather station there, so we can do wind speed and wind direction. And it's all connected to the cell phone system, so we can download the data as we need it, and we can do some checking of the quality of the data and the instrumentation from a far afield. It's about a 10-hour round trip to get there and do some work and then come back. So the less frequent we have to do that, the better. Somewhere in the background, I can't point it out, is the other 10-meter tower, but it's down there somewhere, down that berm, I think. Moving on to slide 25. Here is some TSP data. This is not Moody data. We haven't got the Moody out there yet, but this is TSP data. And I just wanted to put this up to show you that, indeed, our two Superfund sites, in inverted commas, do have contaminated aerosols. The red and the blue bars show Hayden and Iron King, respectively, compared to our other sites like Tucson itself, Green Valley, and Wilcox. And whether the pollutant be arsenic, cadmium, or lead, you can see that Hayden and Iron King have much higher concentrations than the other sites. So it's a good thing to be studying those particular pollutants at those particular sites. So average concentration on the y-axis in part per million. This is now within the aerosol phase, so this is parts of lead per million parts of aerosol, for example. You can see that for Tucson, we do actually have very clean air here, down about 10 parts per million, whereas Hayden and Iron King are way up there, you know, 10 to 100 times the concentration. So not a good place to be breathing air without a dust mask. Moving on to slide 26, also at Iron King, we have a three-dimensional ultrasonic anemometer, so that allows us to do not just the horizontal winds, but also the vertical winds. It takes a little bit of getting used to understand what the data really mean. On the top of that, the figure on the right-hand side, is the mean wind velocity, just the horizontal velocity, irrespective of the direction. So you can see that the wind sort of bumps along about 1 or 2 meters per second, and then every once in a while comes up to 5 or 8 meters per second. 5 to 8 meters per second is really interesting because that's when the dust starts coming up. The wind direction is given by the second chart within that graph. And you can see that, for example, on the beginning of day one, the wind was coming out of almost, you know, between the south and the west, the southwesterly direction. And then midway through the day, the wind was coming out of the west, and then later on the day, beginning of day two, it came out of the southwest again. So that's the angle from which the top wind is coming from. So that's wind speed and wind direction. And then on the bottom is the vertical component of the wind. So most of the time, the wind is pretty horizontal. It's a very flat tailings, and so the angle is 90 degrees. But every once in a while, you can see right in the beginning, say halfway through the very first day between 0 and 1, there were occasions when the wind was coming from above, so we've got high angle, 100 degrees, and then there were occasions when the wind was coming from below, down near 85 degrees or something. And that's of real interest to us because it's the vertical wind that suspends the dust, it's not the horizontal. So we are measuring three-dimensional winds at Iron King right now, and the intention is to put that into a dust model. This next slide on slide number 27 shows some of the problems that are associated with that modeling. The generation of dust is really pretty interesting. The big particles, by that I mean 800 to 2,000 microns diameter, they roll along the surface under the influence of the wind, and we call that creep. So they do not get into the air, they just roll along. The medium-sized particles between 100 and 800 microns diameter, they are lifted a little bit by the wind, so they hop along, and then they bounce down to the surface again. They're too big to be lifted and completely suspended. So they undergo what's called saltation. They bounce around and have that very characteristic shaped curve, steep trajectory as it's lifted off the surface, and then a slower return to the surface. And then there is suspension. So the particles that are less than about 100 microns diameter getting towards that coarse fraction of that trimodal distribution I showed you, that's windblown dust. And that's suspended not by the direct action of the wind, but by the saltating particles. They come down, they bombard the surface, and they physically eject the small particles, and you can see them being suspended in that top left-hand cartoon over there. So somehow the model has to take account of all of that, and to get those less than 100 micron diameter particles up into the air in some realistic way. And there's some basis for doing that, and there's quite a rich literature which you can look up if you're interested. Moving down to slide 28, there's a snapshot of the Iron King tailings. You can see that the top is fairly flat, although there are a few berms and tables on top of it. And we're right now running a fluid dynamics model, a commercially available one called Fluent. And we use that because you can get down to very, very small scales, down to below centimeter scales, which we need to get down to. And this is a first run of the wind flowing over those mine tailings coming from left to right. You can see the higher wind speeds at the top, the red arrows. And then as you get down near the surface, so the friction, the surface friction slows down the wind, and you get to those cooler colors going down to zero when you're actually in contact with the surface. So that very fine scale Fluent fluid dynamics model is up and running. And what we need to do now is to couple that to a larger scale model to make the winds realistic from a weather forecasting model. And that's what the next slide, slide 29, shows you. There is a very good model that one can use called the Weather Research Forecasting Model that the National Weather Service and many other people use to do weather forecasting. And the idea is that we will take Fluent and it will generate a plume. This the Google map on the right shows the Fluent plume. The bright spot right in the middle is the Iron King tailings, the mine tailings. And you can see the plume and the greener, the cooler colors moving directly north, and it's moving directly north because we set up this this fake model with the winds coming from the south. But now we want to use this weather forecast model to drive the real winds, so that plume will move as the winds move. And if that plume moved a bit to the right, for example, here, it would impact Dewey Humboldt, and those people living there would be impacted by an aerosol containing high concentrations of lead and arsenic. Here's some output from that model. This is forecast wind at 10 meter altitude, superimposed on Google Earth. And the longer those arrows, the faster the wind. And you can see the wind speed, wind direction, coupled to the topography. And this model does an absolutely fantastic job. We run it in an operational mode. That means the forecasts are made every day, 7 days a week. It's a very stable system. And we can take those wind speed directions, put in the Fluent, and then drive the dust model. Moving on to slide 31 then, just to give you an idea of how good this WARF model is. When was this? This was July the 5th in Phoenix. There was, during the monsoon season, this huge thunderstorm developed just south of Phoenix. And the downburst from that huge thunderstorm hit the ground and resulted in these very strong winds just pouring out at very high speed heading towards Phoenix. And you can see that on that Google map on the left. The warmer colors, the reds and the yellows, are that downburst just streaming down from the upper levels, hitting the ground and pouring out. And as those winds hit the ground, they kicked up a lot of dust. And you can see on the right-hand side there, this is a photograph of that dust front called a haboob coming out of that storm, that forecast storm, around about 8 o'clock in the evening. That's the ballpark in Phoenix, and we're looking towards the east. So you're seeing the northern side of that dust storm coming through. So I'm showing this just to brag that WARF model does a really good job of wind speed, wind direction. And this was a 24-hour forecast, so we knew this was going to happen a day in advance. Some dust track data, if you're interested. We just began doing some of this work up there, and these dust tracks were set up near Rainer Meyer's vegetated sites. And it gives you a snapshot of what we can do there with the dust tracks in real time. On slide 32, you can see the wind direction coming from the right, going over an unvegetated area. You'd expect higher dust loadings there, and we can do PM1, PM2.5, PM4, PM10, and TSD all at the same time using the dust tracks. And indeed, you can see higher dust levels there. Then when you get to the densely vegetated plot, you see lower dust concentrations. And then across the partially vegetated plot, you see the somewhat higher concentration. So first look, it seems to be doing what you expect, although I'd like to come back and revisit these data as time goes on. Another look at exactly the same data. On the right-hand side, the control, the unvegetated, you can see no vegetation there. Right in the middle, densely vegetated, and Raina will tell you how she makes stuff like that grow in such a terrible environment. And then on the left-hand side, the sparse vegetation, I guess she just doesn't water it or something like that, but those plants are not doing so well. But you can see the difference that the vegetation makes on real-time measurements of PM1 through TSP at the Iron King site using the dust track monitors. And then this is the last slide, another shot of that haboob, that huge dust storm as it was coming through Phoenix. There's some bibliography there you can take a look at. But I like ending up with this slide just to emphasize to people who maybe live on the humid east coast, dust is a huge issue here. You know, you don't want to be in a storm like that. You don't want to be driving your car. You don't want to be breathing it. And you certainly don't want to be downwind or a storm like that if it includes mine tailings coming off Iron King or Hayden, for example. So with that, I'll bring it to a close. Sarah, do we wait for questions?
We'll have some questions now. So thank you, Dr. Betterson, for your presentation. And before we do start the next presentation, we'll go ahead and take some questions. We'll go to the phone lines first. If anyone has a question, please take your phone off mute by pressing *7. State your name and organization and ask your question. And then when you're done, you can remute your phone by pressing *6. So do we have any questions on the phone line? We do have a couple of questions that have come in through the simulcast watchers. Arthur Buchan at Washington State wants to know, is it, when you're measuring the arsenic, is this total arsenic, arsenic 3, or arsenic 5?
We've done no speciation, so this is determined by ICP mass spec, so it's total arsenic.
Okay. Do we have someone on the phone?
Can you hear me? I understood I was muted by the system.
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. I'm Doris Solarius. I live in Prescott near the Iron King site, and I have been visiting with people there for the last 10 years and observing the days when dust from the smell, from the tailings just cover the town. You can't see across the road. So this is a real concern to the community there. When I hear that people should be out in some of that dust without wearing a mask, is this anything that will be shared with the community? I mean, it sounds kind of scary to me. And I know living in Hayden is also rather risky, but I just wonder what your thoughts about actually we're trying to make people feel very good about the cleanup, and if people from the Dewey Humboldt community have listened in on this webinar, what can I tell them or would you tell them about being out in the dust? Like, if it's really dusty, go home and shut the windows? Or what do we say to the people?
What I should emphasize is that when I was saying wear a mask, I was talking about the people who actually work on the tailings themselves. Our group goes up there, they dig holes, they use tractors, and so they're exposed to very high concentrations of dust right at their feet. And so I insist that they wear a mask. When the wind blows and the plume, say, is heading towards Dewey or somebody else, somewhere else, the wind actually dilutes those particles. It dilutes the aerosols. So the concentrations downwind are not as high. And the dilution can be very high. It could be on the order of 100-fold or 1,000-fold, depending on how far downwind you are. But I don't know exactly what the dilution is, and I hope to be able to tell you once we have this model up and running. We're very aware of the fact that there are people living in Dewey Humboldt and that they are concerned with their health, and so we want to be able to provide these forecasts in advance, so if there's going to be a very strong dust storm with high concentrations of aerosols, we could give you some warning. And if necessary, depending on the concentrations, you may want to stay indoors when the wind is blowing.
That's very helpful. And it's also really good to hear that the vegetative plots are helping keep the dust down. That's really good news. Thank you very much, Dr. Betterton.
You're more than welcome.
Okay, we have another question that's in from the simulcast. Viewer, this is Martin Stute at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory in New York. He asks, I am curious what the natural arsenic and lead concentrations in the air in that area would be, assuming similar dust particle concentrations in the air. Or in other words, how much higher is the contaminated dust relative to natural dust per dust mass unit?
If you go to that slide with the TSP from Iron King, let me see if I can find that slide for you going back. This may not be as much detail as you would like. We have more detail, but I just wanted to give you an example here. If you go back to slide 25, there we have the concentration of arsenic in the aerosol. So the concentration units here are parts like micrograms of arsenic per microgram of solid aerosol, ppm. And you can see that for background sites like Wilcox, that's where the dry playa is, the concentrations there and also in Tucson or Green Valley are down at about 10 parts per million within the aerosol fraction itself. Lead is higher on the order of about 100 parts per million, whereas Hayden and Iron King are a few hundred parts per million in the aerosol phase itself. So there's a marked difference between Hayden and Iron King aerosol, but this is just the TSP. I don't have the Moody data in front of me.
Do we have any more questions from the phone lines? Okay, we do have some more coming in on the simulcast. Pete Krupnik from Dewey Humboldt asks whether you have calculated a figure such as the one-year average mass flux for a resident of the town.
No, we have not done any of that. At the moment, we're focusing on just getting that Fluent model up and running. Simple things like getting the topography of the mine tailings, for example, takes a lot of time. Yes, we've got to go out there and measure it. But we're up. We have the topography correct. The model is running. And now it's a matter of getting it initialized with real weather data. So this coming semester, going into June, you'll see quite a lot of activity up there.
Okay. We have another question from Helen Bacher at US EPA Region 10. She asks, I am curious about the use of lead isotopes to identify or distinguish sources. Does the smelting process alter the ratio of lead isotopes? Or are the differences due to difference in the source of ores or concentrates that are brought to the smelter?
It's interesting. In the case of lead, the atomic weight is so high that there's practically no differentiation due to diffusion in the vapor phase, unlike water, for example. So when you're talking about atomic weights in 200 or something, 208, 206, the difference in the diffusion rates is so low that you do not get any a differentiation due to smelting operations. But you do get very big differences due to the source of the ore. And in Hayden, for example, they do smelt ores from two different locations. One's local and one's far removed south of Tucson. And I expect if we can get samples of those two sources, we will see two different lead isotope ratios. But the lead isotopes are a characteristic of the source of the ore, not of the processing.
Okay, do we have any questions on the phone? All right, then we have one more question, and then you'll be off the hook. Wayne Fuller from Nino and Moore in Phoenix asks, is there any plan to directly monitor within the Dewey-Humboldt community in addition to modeling the effects there? This would seem to be important to calibrating the model.
My particular group is not working in the community of Dewey Humboldt. We're working on the tailings, but there may be others within our University of Arizona Superfund group who will be moving into the community this semester, I believe.
Okay. Oh, we have one more question, but I'll ask that person to... Oh, you think we have time? Okay. I'm sorry. We have time to take one additional question here. Arthur Buchan from Washington State asks, has EPA conducted net environmental benefit analysis prior to remediation for lead, cadmium, and arsenic, and would dust produced when remediation takes place be accounted for, especially in vegetated versus non-vegetated areas?
I'm stuck. I can't. I wish there was somebody from EPA who could answer that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. So that might be something to ask maybe your EPA regional project managers
That's
about.
Right.
Okay. Barring no further questions, we'll go ahead and move on to our next speaker. The second presenter today is Dr. Raina Mayer. Raina Mayer is a professor for environmental microbiology in the Department of Soil, Water, and Environmental Science at the University of Arizona. She received her undergraduate degree in biology and chemistry from the University of Minnesota
received her PhD in microbiology from Rutgers University, and trained as a postdoctoral research associate in biochemistry at Iowa State University. She has served as the associate director of the University of Arizona NIEHS Superfund Research Program since 2002. Dr. Mayer's research is interdisciplinary and is focused on developing a fundamental understanding of the biological factors and processes that influence the transport and fate of both microorganisms and chemical contaminants in the environment. The information gained from this research is used in the development of innovative remediation technologies. Today, Dr. Mayer will be telling us about her work on mine tailings phytostabilization at the Iron King Mine and Humboldt Smelter Superfund site in Dewey-Humboldt, Arizona. Take it away, Dr. Mayer.
Well, thank you to Sarah and to Justin Crane from NIHS for coordinating these webinars. And I'm going to follow directly on Dr. Betterton's talk and tell you about some revegetation work that we're doing on the Iron King site to see if we can reduce wind erosion of those tailings and dust emissions from the site. So moving to slide 36, I'd like to start with some background talking about mine tailings themselves and the fact that they're a very inhospitable environment for plants to grow. So if you look at what mine tailings are, they are the waste that's left over out after rock and ore are removed from the ground and crushed very finely. The precious metals are extracted, and then you're left with this finely crushed material, and that's deposited on a pile and left. The characteristics of these materials, which include, in some cases, high metal content, and in some cases, extremely low pH, in all cases, a total lack of soil structure. And by what I mean by soil structure, if any of you are gardeners, when you take a handful of soil and you rub it in your hand, you can see if there are clots and peds that are there. Mine tailings have none of this. And they as well have a very impacted microbial community. Microorganisms are important in soils for cycling of carbon and cycling of nitrogen and basically maintaining a healthy status in a soil. And so as a result, you have limited to no vegetation that occurs naturally on these waste piles that are left over, and this can go on for decades to even centuries. And if you look on the upper right-hand side, the photo shows a mine tailings pile on a windy day. I think you're getting the idea from all of Dr. Betterton's pictures and these. Also on the picture below it, this shows a water erosion channel that occurred in southern Arizona after one of our big monsoon events. And actually about a third of this tailings pile was carried into the neighboring dry wash as a result of water flow. The picture on the middle left side shows children playing in a little pool that's downstream from a mine tailings site. This pool contains very elevated levels of arsenic, and you can see the children are being exposed. And so the goal of revegetating a mine tailings site is to prevent wind erosion, to prevent water erosion, and ultimately to prevent human and ecological exposures from occurring. Moving on to slide 37, again, to reinforce, this is a mine tailing site in Mexico that I visited, and on the top left, this is a site on a still day. On the bottom right, it's the same site on a windy day. And you can see in Mexico, they build their communities, the mining communities, right up against these mine tailings, and so they can be highly exposed. Moving on to slide 38. Our research goals in the area of revegetation is to see whether we can use plants to stabilize mine tailings against erosion processes to reduce the risk of human exposure. And the things that you have to take into account when you're establishing a vegetative cap is that you have to have suitable native plants. You have to establish what are the minimum inputs that are going to be required to allow plants to grow and survive in these tailings. Clearly, if nothing grows on these tailings for decades or centuries, you're going to have to add something to jumpstart plant growth. We want to look at the longevity and succession of a vegetative cap. There have been many studies that have been done by mining companies. Often these are done and reported on after a year or two, and we don't know what happens in the long term, after 5 and 10 years. There's actually very little good information to use to evaluate this as a remediation technology out there. We need to look at metal speciation during revegetation. If you have high metal content in the tailings and metals are taken up by the plant into the shoot tissues, that means that foraging animals can be exposed, and also after the plant dies, that material falls to the ground and can be wind-borne as well. So you want to prevent metals from being taken up from the tailings into plant shoot tissues. And then finally, we're working with Dr. Betterton's group to actually evaluate or quantify the reduction in erosion processes. Moving to slide 39, this is an aerial view of the Iron King Mine Humboldt Smelter site. It was operated from 1904 to 1969, and a variety of metals were mined from the site. The ore processing left behind heavy metals in both soil and water. And in fact, the EPA has just, I believe, completed a number of yard removals from Dewey Humboldt that had excess amounts of metals in the soils. The Iron King tailings represent a fairly worst-case scenario. These tailings are very acidic. They range in pH from 2 to 4. Plants need a pH above 5, usually from about 5 to 6.5 is optimal for plant growth. The tailings contain up to 4,000 milligrams per kilogram of arsenic and a similar amount of lead. And the site was listed as a Superfund site in September of 2008. Moving to slide 40, I'd like to tell you a little bit about preliminary studies that we did in the greenhouse. When you're working with a material as challenging as the Iron King tailings, it's difficult to move right into the field. So we did a number of greenhouse studies initially. We tested the growth of 15 different native species in the tailings, 7 of which survived and some of which thrived. And if you look at the pictures on the right, it shows buffalo grass with a 0% compost amendment, 10%, 15%, and 20%. And you can see the increasing amount of plants produced as you increase the compost amendment. So one question you might ask is, why did we choose compost as our amendment? Compost does a number of things. I should have mentioned in the previous slide that in addition to the tailings characteristics I described, they also have no organic matter and no nitrogen presence, both qualities that are needed for good plant growth. So compost is an immediate amendment that adds organic matter, it adds nitrogen, and it adds a lot of good bacteria, heterotrophic bacteria, that can jumpstart nutrient cycling in the tailings process. If you look at the graph on the left, the y-axis is dry biomass or biomass produced. And along the x-axis are 6 different plants. You can see that buffalo grass did the best. Mesquite, quailbush, and catclaw acacia were very similar. And mountain mahogany and Arizona fescue struggled along with very little biomass production. The black bar is the biomass produced with 10% compost, which is fairly low in all cases. And the red and green bars represent the growth at 15 and 20% compost, And you can see that there's not a lot of difference between the 15 and 20% compost treatment. And so we call 15% the optimal level. Moving on to slide 41, we looked at what compost addition, what the immediate effects of compost addition were. And so if you mix compost and tailings and looked at aqueous metal solubility, the effect of compost was to immediately decrease metal solubility and likely toxicity as well. We also saw an immediate increase in pH, and we also saw an immediate increase in heterotrophic bacterial counts. Again, these are the bacteria that are necessary to carry out carbon and nitrogen cycling. We then looked at what the effects of plants were. So if you take these parameters at time zero, that's the effect of compost. And then if you look at these parameters again at 60 days after plants have started to grow, you can look at what the effects of the plants are. And intriguingly, what we found was that plants were able to prevent the pH in the tailings from decreasing again. So if you look at the graph on the right, the black bar shows the pH immediately after compost has been added at day zero. It increases from about 2.5 originally to about 4.2. The red bar shows the pH after 60 days of incubation in the greenhouse, but without plants. And you can see that the pH declines again. So even if compost immediately increases pH, if you incubate without plants, the pH declines again to background. But if you look at the effects of plants on pH, you can see, and these are in the green and blue bars, you can see that in particular, buffalo grass and mesquite were very adept at not only preventing the pH from decreasing, but actually in making the pH increase to about 6 to 7, which is about the optimal range for plant growth. Mesquite and quail bush similarly prevented pH from decreasing, and the two plants that did not grow as well in the tailings, mountain mahogany and Arizona fescue, perhaps prevented the decrease a little bit, but not very much. So the postdoc working on this project was intrigued with these results, and moving on to slide 42, he developed a really clever assay where he had some auger slabs that were that had a pH indicator in them. So these auger slabs, and look at the picture in part A, have a pH indicator. And without any plants present, it looks orange, and the pH is about 5.5. If you then germinate some seedlings and sandwich them between these auger slabs, you can look at how these seedlings impact pH in the auger. A purple color indicates that the pH has increased to above 6, and you can see in parts B and C, that mesquite and buffalo grass have big purple halos around the root zone, indicating that these plants are actually able to increase the pH in the rhizosphere. In contrast, mountain mahogany and Arizona fescue in part D and E, you can see a little sort of a yellowish halo around those roots, indicating that the pH, if anything, declined or got more acidic. So the effect of plants is very important here. It prevents the pH from decreasing again. A second thing it does, moving on to slide 43, is that plants help maintain high heterotrophic counts. So if you look at the graph on the right, this plots the log of the bacterial counts versus the biomass, or the plants in each pot. And you can see that if nothing grew in the pot, the number of bacteria declined to a couple of hundred after 60 days. But as the amount of biomass in the pot increased, so did the amount of these neutrophilic heterotrophic bacteria. The third thing that we looked at plants to do, as mentioned earlier, was to not accumulate metals in tissue materials. And in the greenhouse, we found that the plants we studied did not shoot accumulate metals above domestic animal toxicity limits, or DATLs, and these are limits that are put out by the USDA for grazing animals. Moving to slide 44, I'd like to talk a little bit now about the field trial that we initiated in May 2010 on the site. And so I'm going to actually take you through a whole bunch of pictures that show sort of the story of how this plot was started. But what I'd like, again, to point out to you is the slide on the lower right-hand side shows a normal windy morning in May at the site. And you can see a great deal of dust is emitted from the site when it's windy. The picture above that shows that our workers at the site, who are mostly students and graduate students, undergraduate students, and postdocs, all have to take OSHA training and all have to wear Tyvek suits and respirators to work on the site. So moving on to slide 45, our objective for the field trial was to determine whether we could translate the successful results from the greenhouse to the field. And sometimes that's pretty hard to do. Moving on to slide 46, this presents a project timeline. May 2010 was the first field trial, when the first field trial began. At that time, we also took soil cores, and I'll show you some pictures of that in a moment. And we have subjected those soil cores to biological, physical, and chemical tests. In September of 2010, we did canopy cover measurements. In October, we collected plant shoot tissue samples for metal analysis. In April of 2011, we implemented a second or a phase two trial. And in May, we took year one core samples from the site, again, to be subjected to biological, physical, and chemical tests. In September of 2011, we did canopy cover and the plant tissue sampling from both phase one and phase two. And then finally, in April of this year, we'll be putting in a third year or third study at the site. And right now, we have funding to follow all of these studies for 5 years. Moving on to slide 47, so I'm going to go quickly through these photos. Here is step one. The site is ripped and disked to sort of even and homogenize the tailings. This is no mean feat. At about an 8 or 10-inch depth at this site, there is a hard pan layer that's very, very hard to break up that's formed. And so we had to go through several different pieces of machinery to actually be able to rip and tear that hard pan up. Slide 48. For each field trial, we have 24 plots, which are 6 treatments with 4 replicates each. And they're laid out and flagged. Slide 49, here's the compost being delivered. This was purchased from a local dairy and is dairy compost, dairy manure compost. Slide 50, the compost is added to selected plots depending on the treatment. Slide 51, we have a truck scale on site that we can use to weigh the compost to make sure that each treatment gets the right amount. Slide 52, just showing addition of the compost to each plot. And then slide 53, mixing the compost into the tailings. It's mixed to a depth of about 6 inches. Slide 54, compost amendment is completed. Slide 55 shows one of the workers taking a soil core, and we took triplicate soil cores from each plot, again for biological, physical, and chemical analysis. Slide 56, just showing a close-up of the core. Slide 57, the next step was to seed the site, and as I'll explain in one of the next slides, we used a mix of grass, shrubs, and tree seeds on the site. I don't know if you can tell in this picture, but we did all of this at night. And one of the reasons we did it at night is the winds are much calmer, and we didn't lose as much seed on the wind current by doing this at night. And also, it's much cooler at night. Slide 58, setting up the irrigation. So we have 4 big tanks, and they are shown in slide 59. And these are filled from an on-site well. Slide 60 is setting out the irrigation line, drip lines. And slide 61, putting on some finishing touches. And slide 62, May 18th, 2010, was the beginning of the field trial. Okay, so in slide 63 now, I'd like to show you a little more detail about the field plots and treatments. This is a cool Google Earth picture that apparently was taken just after we finished our phase two trial, setting up the phase two trial. So you can sort of see 2 big rectangles in the middle of the picture, each with 24 plots in them. Slide 64. This shows the phase one field trial, and the plants selected included some grasses, buffalo grass and Arizona fescue, some shrubs, quail bush and mountain mahogany, and some trees, mesquite and acacia, and we used these different plants to try and give different rooting depths and rooting patterns, and also to give different types of canopy cover for dust emission. As I already said, we have 6 treatments, and each of them are replicated 4 times, and it's done in a randomized block design except for the unamended control. So if you look at the color-coded grid on top of the tailings, you can see that the white blocks are the unamended controls, and they are at the upper corner, upper left-hand corner, and the lower right-hand corner. And they are not randomly distributed because it was really hard with the tractor to avoid getting compost into them if they would have been in the middle. The treatments were, for phase one, 15% compost with seeds and without seeds, 20% compost with seeds and without seeds, and 10% compost with our 2 best performing plants only, buffalo grass and mesquite, and then an unamended control, so no compost and no plants. Moving to slide 65, now I'm showing you the phase two plots, and I don't want to belabor this, but what we're testing in phase two is the addition of plant growth promoting bacteria to see if we can get them to help the plants establish, and also the addition of lime. Lime, of course, being an agent that increases pH immediately to see if that helps establish plants. Moving to slide 66, I'm going to talk a little bit in these next few slides about the methodologies we've used to evaluate the vegetative caps. So first of all, we don't want to actually remove any of the plants to weigh them to measure biomass. And so we're evaluating plant growth using canopy cover. And we use something called the Dahmenmeier frame method two diagonal transects are made in each plot, and then we use plexiglass frames that are shown in the slide on the right hand side, along each transect. You can see the blue squares and the red squares, and in the center of each of the triangles in the white squares. So we use these plexiglass frames to estimate the percent of that area within the frame that has plant growth. Moving to slide 67, we evaluated neutrophilic heterotrophic bacterial counts, and we did this by taking samples from the cores we took. We did normal serial dilutions and did plate counts on R2A media, and these were counted after 5 days. Moving to slide 68, we measured shoot uptake of metals. Here, plant tissue samples were harvested. They were taken to the lab. They were washed in acid to remove all of the metals from the exterior of the leaf. We just want to know what's inside the leaf. Dried, microwave digested, and measured by ICP-MS analysis. Moving on to slide 69, we used the same core samples to measure electrical conductivity as a measure of salinity or salt concentration and pH using a one-to-one paste. And moving on to slide 70. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the results for canopy cover, heterotrophic counts, shoot metal uptake, pH and EC for the first 17 months of this trial. So moving to slide 71, just to give you a visual idea of what this revegetation trial looks like. It was established in May, and here we have June, July, August, September, October photos showing that the plants actually are growing, and it was quite a thrill for all of us to see that all of this hard work actually yielded plants on the site. And in the bottom right-hand side, you see the unamended control, so there's no compost and no seeds, and, of course, no plants. So moving on to slide 72, this graph shows canopy cover results, and it's a busy table, so let's go through it slowly. On the first column are the treatments. The second column are the 5 months canopy cover results that show about a 30% canopy cover for all of the composted treatments with seeds. And even in the composted treatments without seeds, you see a little bit of canopy cover, maybe 4 to 6%. And these were volunteer seeds that seem to have blown in from the plots next door. Okay, so we got a 30% canopy cover. And if you look at the previous slide again, you can see that visually this looks like a pretty extensive canopy cover. We measured again at 17 months, and what you see is that the canopy cover has declined a little bit to 18 to 26%. We discussed this quite a bit to determine whether this is a bad thing or if the plants are dying off. But actually, I'll show you some evidence that says perhaps we overseeded the plots and got too big a response in the beginning. And by 17 months, the plots are just sort of equilibrating. And if you actually look at the canopy cover on these plots and compare it to canopy covers in the surrounding area, this value of 18 to 26% is pretty normal for the area. Interestingly enough, the treatments with no seeds increased a little bit between 5 and 17 months. Moving on to slide 73, this is just an interesting picture from a plot that received no seeds. So this is a volunteer plant that's sort of in the center of the picture. You can see it's growing very, very healthily. But when we went and looked at the sort of how the roots grow, you can see how we've sort of dug holes to follow the roots. It appears that all of these plants are sending out very shallow horizontal root systems and avoiding going down into the tailings themselves, which are still fairly toxic and very low pH. Moving on to slide 74, these are some more photos just looking at fairly healthy, lush vegetative stands that are actually blooming and seeding. Moving on to slide 75. This table shows the results of the neutrophilic heterotrophic counts, and what I'd like you to look at first is the very bottom row, the unamended control. So the number of bacteria that we find in these tailings without any amendments is about 100 to 300 bacteria per gram. A normal healthy soil has about 1 million bacteria per gram. So this is a very, very impacted or stressed out material. At 0 months, immediately after adding the compost, we see a 2 to 3 log increase in the bacterial count. So instead of 10 to the 2, you see 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5. And then after 14 months, if you read horizontally across, you see there's another 1 to 2 log increase in counts, going from 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 7. So we view this as a very positive finding, showing that the plants that are establishing in concert with a very healthy microbial community that hopefully will start a normal healthy soil process that includes normal biogeochemical cycling. Moving on to slide 76. This table shows the results of the shoot uptake of metals. The first column on the left shows we measured arsenic, lead, and zinc. The next column are the total metal concentrations in the tailings. The third column is the domestic animal toxicity limits published by the USDA for each metal. And then you can see in the results columns, 15 and 20%, that all of these plants are lower than the domestic animal toxicity limits. The shoot accumulation is lower than the DATL, except for the very bottom row, which is quail bush and zinc. So quail bush accumulates a little bit more than the DATL for zinc, but in all other, for both arsenic and lead, we are less than the DATL, indicating that these plants are probably pretty good candidates for revegetation. Moving on to slide 77. This is some initial characterization of pH and electrical conductivity, and these are contour plots. The one on the left shows pH, and you can see that the unamended control plots, which are in the upper left-hand corner and the lower right-hand corner, are red, meaning they're pH 2, and wherever compost was amended, you can see the pH is going up to pH 6 or even 7. The EC shows that the EC increases a little bit when you add compost, and that is because the EC of the compost itself is fairly high, and higher, in fact, than the tailings. Moving to slide 78, this is a little bit of data. It's not contour plots, but it's a little bit of data showing pH after 17 months. And we took the pH from the cores, and so we were able to look at 3-inch depth. This is with the compost amendment, and 9-inch depth, which is lower than the compost amendment. And what's intriguing about this is that the unamended control has at 3 inches a pH of 2.5, and then as you increase the compost amendment, you increase the pH in the tailings. At 9 inches, the lower the compost is, the pH is around 2.5 in both the unamended control and 10% compost. Intriguingly, the pH is going up a tiny bit in the 15 and 20% compost. And so we'll be watching this really carefully in the next few years to see if plant establishment in the tailings allows plant roots or plant exudates even to move below the compost zone and impact the properties of the tailings themselves. Moving to slide 79, I'm just going to show one graph on canopy cover from phase two. And so this was the second year trial where we were looking at plant growth promoting bacteria and lime addition. And what I'd like to point out is that it does not appear that as of this first measurement at 5 months, plant growth promoting bacteria has helped at all. But the addition of lime nearly doubles the canopy cover measured in 15% compost as well as in the 10% compost treatment. So we're actually really excited about this lime treatment. Moving on to slide 80. Again, this is just to show you some pictures of the field trial from phase two. And this is 5 months after the site was planted. And you can see that some of the plots are really thriving. Others of the plots have more spotty or sparse vegetation. And something I'd like to say, just to tie into Dr. Betterton's talk a little bit, is that you don't need 100% canopy cover to greatly reduce dust emissions from the tailings. And so I think one of the neat things, pieces of information that we'll get from this study in collaboration with Dr. Betterton is the relationship between the amount of canopy cover that you need to significantly reduce dust emissions from the site. Moving on to slide 81. This is a 15% compost seeded and limed treatment. And what I want to point out here is after this particular plot was rained on, and the rain actually caused a lot of flooding and saturation of the site, we saw a lot of dieback of the plants. So you can see these brown plants sort of ringing around the plot. And if you move to slide 82 then, what you see is that these plants have now come back after the site dried again. We saw emergence of fresh plants, new plants, and the site has actually taken off. So depending on the weather at the site, we can see these plants die back a little bit, but then recover again. And moving to slide 84, in conclusion, the greenhouse results translated very, very well to the field, in fact, surprisingly well to the field. We have found that percent canopy cover increases with the rate of compost amendments, but it appears that you need this minimum of 15% compost to get good canopy cover. We have found that the establishment of the vegetative cap increases neutrophilic heterotrophic bacteria. And the reason I keep harping on this and very interested in it is that it's very easy for a practitioner in the field to measure heterotrophic bacteria. And I think that the number of heterotrophic bacteria in a mining site can indicate the level of stress at that site and begin to indicate the minimum amendments, the minimum amount of compost that you're going to need to establish a vegetative cap. So it can give you information on what you'll need to establish a vegetative cap, and then after the vegetative cap is established, it can give you information on whether or not the plant cap is being successful. So if you're maintaining nice high counts, it appears that you've got a healthy plant stand on the site. The other criteria that has come out of this work that's really interesting is that there are some plants that appear to be able to adjust the pH in the rooting zone. And in fact, they appear to be able to increase the pH in these extremely acidic mine tailing sites. And this little auger assay that my student developed and used in this project is actually a very easy assay to implement and would be very easy to screen a large number of native plants for their potential to adjust pH in any mine tailing site. So moving on to slide 85, I'd just like to thank Region 9 EPA, first Leah Butler and now Monica O'Sullivan, were extremely helpful in gaining access to this site. And as well, I'd like to thank the site owner, Stephen Shookhart, who has been very helpful in allowing us to work on the site and even in supplying some of his own labor to help us fill our irrigation tanks to make sure that we have proper irrigation at the site. The number of people who have worked on this, both from my lab and my colleague John Chorver's lab, is too many to list right now, but we have a group of dedicated people. I'd like to give a shout-out to Scott White, who is our field expert, and also to Juliana Gill, who's a graduate student, who has made most of the measurements that I've presented in this talk today. Moving to slide 86, photos all were taken by the people who have worked on the site, and this is a scarecrow that they built in one of their free moments at the site, who now looks quite orange after a year in the field. And moving to slide 87, you can follow this field study. We have it up on a website. And I've given you the URL, so if you're interested, please take a look. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Mayer. We have a number of questions coming in from the simulcast viewers, but first I'd like an opportunity for anyone on the phone to come in and ask a question. Again, you press star 7 to unmute. Do we have anyone on the phone? Okay. And actually, I guess before I go ahead and do all the questions, I'm supposed to make sure that everyone is aware of the links page and the online feedback forum where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic and that will stay with the seminar indefinitely after the presentation. These seminars will be placed in an archive with the soundtrack. In the near future, you will then be able to access the slides and hear the presentation and questions as they were given today. Associated with the link page is an online feedback forum, and we would love it if you could fill that out as we do look at the comments to continue to try and improve the content and delivery. These links can be found on the last slide of the presentation. So now I will go to some of the questions coming in from the simulcast viewers. One of the questions was referring to slide 68, where you were talking about methodology of measuring the shoot uptake, and this is from David Bieber at Geocon Consultants in California. He wanted to know, was metal concentration in the leaf rinse state measured as well?
No, it was not. That actually be very interesting because it'd tell you a little bit about the deposition of dust onto the tailings, but we have not measured that.
Okay. Another question that we have comes from Stephen Hoffman at US EPA in Washington, D.C. How does dairy compost compare chemically with sewage sludge compost, such as sludge amended with vegetative matter like leaves and grass cuttings?
So that's a great question. There's a lot of interest in using biosolids or compost. One of the reasons we chose compost for this site is that has a little more community acceptability, but it's also a little more mature form of compost. Biosolids, the organic carbon in biosolids tends to break down more quickly and be less long-lasting than a well-composted dairy manure such as what we use.
Okay. Another question from David Bieber at Geocon Consultants in California is, what species were included in the seed mix, and if mesquite was not included, why not, since based on greenhouse studies, it appeared to be one of the two more effective species?
That's a great question. We included six different species in these studies, buffalo grass, Arizona fescue, quail bush, mountain mahogany, mesquite, and acacia. What's really intriguing is that buffalo grass had an over 90% germination rate, which is incredible. You don't normally get those kinds of germination rates from native seeds, but we did. And so we found that in plots that had buffalo grass, it sort of took over, quail bush. The quail bush sort of took over everything. In the 10% compost plot that only had buffalo grass and mesquite, the buffalo grass did very, very well. So it really depends on what the germination rate is and the amount of seed that you put on. One thing we have learned from this is that in the phase one, we put on too many seed. And it allowed a lot of more scrawny plants to grow versus a lesser number of very healthy single plants to grow. And so we are actually in phase two. We cut back on the amount of seeds that we used, and we'll be evaluating how that affects eventual canopy cover. But if you look at the unseeded plots, the plants that do grow in those unseeded plots tend to be much, much larger and appear much healthier than the plants that grow sort of more crowded and competitively in the seeded plots.
Okay. We have a question about the watering. Katrina Higgins Coltrane from Dallas, Texas asks, what level of watering and for how long was that watering continued in order to prevent growth? And in reference to the recovery, did you offer any help when your plots were noted to be dying?
So the dying actually came from oversaturation. When the plots got a little ponded, that's when the plants seemed to die back, and when the ponding went away, they came back again. In terms of irrigation, I can't recall the exact numbers, but I believe that we put on about 8 inches a year, in about half-inch increments, weekly to biweekly in the summers. But all of that information is given on the website that I provided on the last page of the presentation. So we measured both rainfall. We have a weather station there, so we measured both rainfall and we measured our irrigation. We have not stopped irrigating the phase one as yet. We're going to have to make a big decision whether to irrigate it for a third summer or not coming up. And we're kind of arguing about that right now. I'd love some feedback.
Okay, so speaking of your timeline, Raj Krishnamurthy from the U.S. Forest Service in Colorado asks, in a study like this, what do you consider a long-term study? In other words, what's the optimum time in years for a long-term study to properly evaluate all the factors, including leachability of metals?
I think, in my opinion, 10 years is the minimum for a long-term study. We have 5 years of funding for this study, and I hope to be able to extend that to another 5 years beyond the end. But in my opinion, you need about 10 years to ask all of those good questions about metal leachability and, in fact, metal speciation that occurs in the rooting zone. So we know very little about what happens to metals in these tailings as plants establish. Do they become more bioavailable or less bioavailable? And my colleague, John Chorover, is working to examine some of that in the Iron King tailings, and that's a whole other seminar.
Okay, and so that was another question that we had received. So today you have not yet done metal speciation for pre- and post-vegetation?
That is correct. We have the samples collected, and we are beginning to analyze them.
Okay. We have a few more questions on the simulcast, but in the meantime, I'd like to ask, do any of our phone listeners have a question you would like to ask? You can press star 7 to unmute and ask your question. Okay. Then we have a few more questions about... Oh, and also we are, people are more than likely to ask additional questions for Dr. Betterton if anyone did not have a chance to ask your burning questions at the beginning of, before the second seminar started. We have a few questions about your amendments. So this is Christine Edwards at the Montana Office, Region 8 EPA. Did you allow your compost to neutralize for a period of time prior to application because they'd seen similar compost used in Region 8 had burned some of the vegetation? And then another question she asked is about your lime source. They had found sugar beet lime as a good source, but you need to account for active acidity and potential acidity. Do you have any comments on your lime source and whether your compost was neutralized?
The compost was composted by the dairy before we got it. So it was not a raw, it was not the raw manure. It was a well-composted dairy manure. And if you look at those pictures, I think you can kind of see that. The lime we bought was a hydrated lime from a commercial source. And I don't have the details beyond that, but if you send me an email, I will get you that information.
This seems to be a bit more of a comment, but Rufus Cheney from USDA Agriculture Service says, I believe that soil pH changes with plants is due to differences in anion and cation uptake, so nitrate media promote a rise in pH while ammonium causes lowering of pH as the roots take up nitrogen and grow. So the lime treatment is likely to be much more valuable than plant differences and apparent pH change in the agar assay. Does that make sense?
Yes. Hi, Rufus. Thanks for your comment.
I don't think I read that well.
Thanks for your comment. Yes, I think that's true. You may be able to overcome, you may be able to, by using lime, overcome the individual effect of the plant. But our research is trying to also look at how can you minimize whatever amendments that you're adding, because the more amendments you add, the higher the cost of the remediation. And in fact, this gives me an opportunity to comment that most sites actually put on a cover of 6 to 12 inches of soil before they start planting. And to bring in that volume of material is sometimes difficult depending on where you are, and it is expensive. And so the question is, what are the very, very minimum inputs that you can get away with putting into a site and still get plants to establish and grow and reduce wind and water erosion?
Okay. Similar type comment question with some experience in this. Wayne Fuller at Nino and Moore in Phoenix, Arizona says, while it has not been tried very widely, a reclamation of mine tailings in Arizona that I was used a rock armor over the tailings and then seeding. The rocks helped with stabilization, reduced wind and water erosion, provided sheltered shaded pockets for the seeds, trapped rainfall, and helped reduce seed predation. I'm wondering if such an approach is being considered for the trials at Dewey Humboldt.
That's a great suggestion. We haven't considered that so far, but I'm aware that that's been done, and it's a good suggestion. Again, there you have a lot of heavy equipment bringing in a lot of heavy rock.
Okay, and then we had a follow-up question about watering the plants from Katrina Higgins-Coltrane. If the watering is stopped, would you expect vegetation growth to continue, and would you consider this to be a low-maintenance solution to tailing stabilization?
Yeah, native plants should be able to grow on their own after the first couple of years without irrigation. And so our expectation is that we should be able to stop irrigation maybe even this year for the phase one and have these plants survive.
Okay. Do we have any questions for Dr. Betterton or Dr. Mayer, either over the phone or if anyone wants to type in any last-minute questions on the simulcast? Okay, well, if there are no more questions, then we will conclude at this time. You can contact Dr. Betterton and Dr. Mayer via email with additional questions, and their email address is on the additional resources page. I would like to thank both of our presenters today for their time in preparing and sharing their presentations with us. This will conclude today's presentation. Thank you for your participation.